World leaders converging on Washington for a 75th anniversary NATO summit. They were sold a show of strength hosted by the alliance's driving force. But beyond the family photos, there's a feeding frenzy. The White House swamped by questions over the fitness of a U.S. president who's older by 6 years than the defense and security pact that in those days bound together nations against the threat of Soviet expansion. Long before Monday's bombing of a civilian children's hospital in Kyiv, NATO leaders already knew they were coming up to decision time, whether to keep helping Ukraine play defense or risk direct confrontation with Moscow by giving Volodymyr Zelensky the planes and missiles his country needs to take Vladimir Putin on Russia's home soil. What should the final communique from the summit say? With Biden and the likes of France's Emmanuel Macron weakened politically these days, NATO's 76th year will be crucial, what with isolationist nativists on the march on both sides of the Atlantic. Today in the France 24 debate, Ken Biden and NATO dispel doubts. With us, she haunted the halls of the White House as our Washington correspondent, France 24 International Affairs editor, Ketevan Gorgestani. Thanks for being with us. Thanks as well to retired General Dominique Trinquant, former head of the French military mission to the United Nations. Good to see you.
Good evening.
From Washington, Justin Logan, Director of Defense and Foreign Policy Studies at the Cato Institute Think Tank. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And we welcome back academic Molly McHugh, lead writer at the Substack publication Great Power. Good to see you.
Good to see you.
If you're on the go, if you want to listen to the show, well, you can like and subscribe to the podcast version of the France 24 debate. Even before the summit began, Joe Biden announcing 5 new air defense missile systems for Ukraine. NATO, through the White House, announcing that Denmark and the Netherlands had started sending those long-awaited F-16 fighter jets to Ukraine. Norway says it's pledging more, enough to dispel doubts. Emerald Maxwell has the story. Distinguished guests.
They've long been on Ukraine's wish list to give it a combat edge against Russian firepower. Now NATO members say they've begun sending some F-16 fighter jets Kyiv's way as they gathered at a summit in Washington.
I'm also pleased to announce that as we speak, the transfer of F-16 jets is underway, coming from Denmark, coming from the Netherlands. And those jets will be flying in the skies of Ukraine this summer.
Separately, a number of NATO countries confirmed they were giving Ukraine Patriot air defense systems, long sought by President Volodymyr Zelensky and seen as crucial to protecting against Moscow's increased aerial assaults. In a draft communique prepared for the meeting of the 32-nation military alliance, the Allies said that they intend to provide Ukraine with minimum funding of 40 billion euros in military aid within the next year. The final declaration, which still has to be formally approved, also referred to Ukraine being on an irreversible path to NATO membership.
Words such as irreversible and bridge will be found in the summit declaration. Why is this important? Because the only thing that Putin and Russia understands is power. And Putin and Russia need to understand that what they expected to do, the exact reverse happened.
The US and other member nations have made clear, though, that Ukraine will only be allowed to join the military alliance after its war with Russia ends.
Dominique Trinquant, I don't know how many times over the past years we've talked about F-16s. Now that the announcements come, your reaction?
I think it's happened. We're discussing that for 2 years now, roughly. What is interesting is that the announcement is made by US, but in fact they are provided by European country. And
this is carefully orchestrated, right?
Yes, of course. But why? Because to provide this F-16 to Ukraine, this country will buy F-35, which is a good deal for US industry. Probably the U.S. have several F-16 to provide directly. They didn't did it. So I think that at the same time, it's a very good news for Ukraine. No discussion about that. But at the same time, we see behind that the the different discussion inside NATO, in fact.
Is it window dressing, or will these planes make a difference?
No, make a difference, I don't know, but be very useful, certainly, for several reasons. The first thing is air defense. They will be able to shut down Russian aircraft who will bomb in Ukraine, so they will be able to do that. There was several words given by the defense minister who say that, you know, the American were not happy about sending long-range weapon in Russia, but air defense was another subject. So I think that they will use the F-16 to shoot down the Russian aircraft and stop bombing in Ukraine. But also, when there will be an offensive, the Ukrainian can use them also to strike the Russian forces.
So you're not saying if, but when?
Sorry?
You're not saying if, but when the Ukrainians launch an offensive?
When? I don't know. I don't see that this year. I will see that in a year time, not now.
Justin Logan, you share this as a piece of good news, the fact that Ukraine is getting these F-16s?
Certainly, it's good news for the Ukrainians. I think there has been a tendency to look for a military silver bullet to a conflict that is really relying on attritional warfare. This is the Russian playbook. We've seen it over and over again. It's throw ordnance at a problem until it goes away. Sometimes it takes a long time. Sometimes it doesn't go away, but there's a tremendous amount of ruin and destruction between the beginning and the end of the conflict. The Ukrainians have obviously wanted F-16s. Now the F-16s are being delivered. I think there's a lot of reason to worry about the training, the pace of the training that has been escalated for Ukrainian pilots to fly F-16s. They're not the most advanced airplanes in the world, but they're quite complicated. And the U.S. and other countries that have been training Ukrainian pilots have been doing it at a pace that is not common in the West. So there may be some wrinkles there, but certainly the Ukrainians will be pleased. But I worry that it's not going to be a silver bullet that's going to materially affect the conflict.
Do you agree with that, Molly McHugh?
I think sort of in the middle, the F-16s are really important. The Ukrainians need additional air defense capabilities. And especially right now, when we've been talking about Kharkiv recently, the majority of the ordnance being dropped there was glide bombs, and having jets that just push back the ability of the Russians to fly in Ukrainian airspace as freely as they have been can save civilian lives in significant numbers. And I think that's something we always need to be looking at in terms of changing the pace of the conflict. I think what we're seeing from NATO this summer, the jets finally coming, more air defense systems finally being pledged. These are things that should have happened 2 years ago. So it's good to see that they are finally arriving. And I think that it will, in fact, materially change the tempo of the conflict in Ukraine this summer.
Yeah, I want to talk more in detail about what's going on in Ukraine and what's going to be in the final communique coming out of this NATO summit, which, according to our correspondent, is not yet, the ink is not yet dry on it. They haven't yet come up with the exact formulation they want. But there's the other issue, which is the hosts. Daily White House briefings have proved a bruising exercise of late. Here's just a snippet from an exchange in Tuesday's briefing. It's between a Fox News reporter and the White House press secretary.
Well, he also said he's sharp as before 8 p.m. So say that the Pentagon at some point picks up an incoming nuke. It's 11 p.m. Who do you call? The First Lady?
He has a team that lets him know of any news that is pertinent and important to the American people. He has someone or that is decided, obviously, with his National Security Council on who gets to tell him that news.
You see her face. This doesn't come in a vacuum. This has been all week, Ketevan Gorgeous.
This has been all week. It has been a pretty tough week for Karine Jean-Pierre at the podium because of course, that catastrophic debate performance for Joe Biden. Then there was that report by the New York Times about this neurologist specialized in Parkinson's disease who made these trips to the White House. There were questions about whether he was seeing the president, why he was there, why they were not giving that information to the White House. That was cleared up a little bit later on. But she's been facing all of those questions about Joe Biden's performance, his fitness, when he goes to bed, when he gets up, who talks to him, when does he plan his events? Do they change his schedule according to when he gets tired? I mean, it's been pretty much relentless, but it has to be said that there is part of it, which is just the press corps asking questions about the fitness of the U.S. president, which is absolutely normal. And there is increasing, and we've seen it over time, there is also a little bit of frustration from the press corps as to how the White House press shop is actually handling the communication around that topic. It took a while for them to hold a press briefing after the debate. There are certain things that Karine Jean-Pierre, for example, says, we're not going to give you that name, we're not going to give you that name. And then 5 hours later, you get a letter from the doctor saying, yes, that was this person was there. So there's this impression that they're trying to hide something, even if it's not true. It's just the way it is handled has also fed the pointed questions of the reporters and the fact that they're not letting go of that topic.
So what's conventional thinking, General Trinquant, in French military circles when they see what's going on in the U.S.? Okay, this is all part of the second guessing. It's part of a campaign, but it's better to have, you know, this is just infotainment, or is there real worry?
No, there is really, there are questions. I mean, you know, this summit of NATO, and the leader of NATO is the U.S., and the leader of U.S. is the president. And so there are discussion about the fact that will this leader inside NATO will still be a leader able to lead the coalition or the alliance. So at the same time, you've got Trump, which is very aggressive about what's happening in NATO. So really, I think that currently this summit in Washington is very important to the cohesion of the alliance with the American, but also with the European, with the French, with the Hungarian, with the Turks. I think it's a difficult situation when at the same time Mr. Putin showed that he's very strong. He's meeting with Indian, with Vietnamese, with North Korea. You've got this Chinese troops in Belarus currently, at the same time that we've got
these exercises, these military exercises near the Polish border.
Yeah, I think it's not important. What is important is the message sent on the communication. Why you show this picture just when there is this meeting at Washington? Why you show pictures of Chinese soldier on the border of Poland in Belarus? You know, it's not dangerous in military terms. It's just they want to show that the Chinese are strongly with Russia because they are in Belarus. And this is something which could ask questions during the meeting in Washington.
Molly McHugh, yeah, those Chinese troops popping up in Belarus, that's all about the NATO summit. It is a public relations exercise.
I think there's been a lot of strategic messaging from Russia this week. I think the things that we should see are the Chinese troops are in Belarus and you have this summer reunion tour of non-NATO goons happening as everyone meets everyone and talks about their strength. But the Chinese are in Belarus because Russia is busy doing other things. And what they've shown us this week is they're going to drop missiles on a Ukrainian children's hospital. And what that should do is motivate all of us to reinvest in the alliance, to commit new resources to our defense, to sort of refocus the core of NATO's mission in Europe where it should be, and then to engage in partnerships that will help us be better at projecting power into Asia as well. We have a lot of priorities on the agenda, and yes, everybody seems to be flirting with some sort of isolationism at the moment. But what our adversaries keep reminding us is we don't really have the luxury of living in our little apocalypse bunkers and hoping the problem goes away. We are at a point of confrontation between systems of freedom and not freedom. And it's really just that simple. And that war right now is in Ukraine. It will not stay in Ukraine if we do not win it there.
Justin Logan, you agree?
No, I think it's quite dangerous, excuse me, to frame this conflict in these kinds of ideological terms. And I think, by and large, the European states reflect that geography is a better explainer of this conflict than is ideology. So if you look at the people, the countries that are the most exercised about this conflict, understandably, it's the Poles, the Baltic states, because they're closest to the action, right? It's always been the case in NATO that the frontline state wants to move the frontline away from them, beyond them, if at all possible. And if you look at countries much further west that face much less of a threat geographically from the Russian military, like Spain or Italy, for example, they're much less concerned about it. They're spending less as a percentage of their GDP on defense for the simple fact that the Russian military can't get to them. And then if you go to Nebraska in the United States or Minnesota or somewhere and ask people, how threatened do you feel by Russia? Understandably, by dint of geography, they feel much less threatened. So the Biden administration has said off and on that this is about the struggle between democracy and autocracy, sort of overlooking all the political pathologies that remain inside Ukraine. And then they've gone at other times to a kind of military Keynesian argument, saying that this war is really good for business because we get to sell lots of weapons. So their messaging has kind of been all over the place. But I think that the least accurate description of what's going on here and what animated the conflict in the first place is high ideology. I think it's much more grubby and mundane than that.
Grubby and mundane? I mean, Vladimir Putin spelled it out. He said he had a notion of a greater Russia, talking about reconstituting a past empire. I'm paraphrasing here, but that's not nothing. That's not anecdotal.
So there's definitely ideology always and everywhere in politics. So it's not to say that one thing causes everything. But if you look at Set the Wayback Machine about how we got on this primrose path, in 2008, the Bush administration strong-armed its European allies to declare that Georgia and Ukraine would someday become members of NATO. Within months, Vladimir Putin invaded Georgia, and Georgia has been a basket case ever since then. In 2014, subsequently, he annexed Crimea. And then in 2022, as we well know, he invaded Ukraine. So I think
he invaded the east of Ukraine in 2014.
Yes, I said he annexed Crimea in 2014.
No, also the Donbass.
Sure. Well, the central result was the annexation of Crimea. But my point is that he's been quite clear about this even since before 2008. In 2007, at the Munich Security Conference, he famously had this outburst where he said, this is a huge provocation. So to wave all of this away and to settle on one deranged ideological speech that he gave before the invasion, I think, is reductive in its own way.
Molly McHugh?
I think there's a lot of facts in that last statement that probably deserve countering on their own. But I mean, this is just, if you want to use the argument that it was us that provoked Putin and it would never have happened if not, it's just factually incorrect. I mean, Putin attacked Estonia in 2007, and this wasn't just a cyber attack. This was also kinetically planned intelligence operations inside the country. This is how he envisioned rebuilding, as he puts it, Russian greatness. They do not view themselves as a contained nation. They view themselves as an empire that needs to reestablish the empire. That is not the kind of world we live in, where you change borders by force, where aggression can determine the fate of entire peoples, where the will of individuals voting in their own countries no longer matters because some guy over there is going to tell you something else. I mean, you want to talk about geography. All right, let's talk about Chinese troops in Belarus. That's not really the geography I think anybody wants to refer to right now. We're in an ideological struggle, whether we want to be or not. And we've done this before in history where we've decided it's not really our problem. And history shows up at our doorstep and brings us back into it. It is far better for us to understand what we are up against as allies with the needed strength of alliance with us and figure out a course for the future than to just wish that it goes away.
Donald Trump, mentioned earlier by General Trinquant, he brought up NATO at a campaign rally Tuesday in Miami, Florida. Let's listen.
And today he's with the people from NATO And these people are sharp. I know them very well, every one of them. They're very smart. They're at the top of their game. And they're saying, what the hell is with this guy? We can't figure it out.
So Trump taking aim at Joe Biden. At the same rally, he riffed on his claim that when he was the first U.S. president back in 2017 ever to demand that fellow NATO members pay their fair share for common defense.
I didn't even know what the hell NATO was too much before, but it didn't take me long to figure it out, like about 2 minutes. And the first thing I figured out was they weren't paying.
Yeah. Kedavan Gorgestani, the optics of the U.S. presidential race, you're saying that that's what's weighing on the minds of the foreign diplomats, foreign leaders that are attending this NATO summit. That's their number one concern.
Yes, I was talking to a diplomatic source in Washington earlier today, and I asked him, I framed the picture as, what is the vibe in Washington among European diplomats? Emmanuel Macron is a little bit weakened, Olaf Scholz might be a little bit weakened, Joe Biden is weakened. And he sort of dismissed that, saying that's a little bit overblown. Your view of it is a little bit overblown. What we are worried about is not necessarily, we're not focused necessarily on Joe Biden's fitness. It's more about the result of the election. And that was true before Joe Biden's performance at the debate. Whether or not Donald Trump is going to win the election in November is the top worry of Europeans and NATO allies as a whole. They're really looking at that because they're saying, yes, in public, you have these comments like Stoltenberg, who just said earlier today, I expect that the U.S. will remain a strong and staunch NATO ally, whatever the outcome of the U.S. presidential election. Is it wishful thinking? Is it a public messaging? In private, they are worried about what that means. And even Vladimir Zelensky, for example, said, I don't know what Donald Trump means for the future of NATO support to Ukraine. Maybe nothing will happen, but maybe it will. And this uncertainty is the problem because NATO is also the core of it is to know that NATO will be there. If you have uncertainty, it doesn't have. He doesn't have to say, I'm going to pull out of NATO for it to be a problem. He just has to say what he has said in the past months and years, which is, maybe I won't, maybe I will, and criticize and say it's not really important. And all of that creates the idea that the number one country, as you were saying, in the NATO alliance might not be reliable in 6 months' time.
Let's listen to Volodymyr Zelensky. He was speaking Tuesday in a panel discussion in Washington. He was asked what he thought of the November presidential election in the United States.
I hope that that United States will never go out from the NATO. I hope that if people of America will vote for President Trump, I hope that his policy with Ukraine will not change.
Justin Logan, will the United States become unreliable to NATO partners should Donald Trump win?
I think it's a little surreal to be talking about Europe in the year of our Lord 2024 in the context where European countries are helpless without the United States. We're in this state of sort of dyspepsia thinking about the United States not being the guarantor of first resort of Europe's security. And I think that, you know, Jens Stoltenberg has been at great pains to talk about the advantages. There have been news stories in Washington about the extent to which he's selling the alliance to Americans. And he does these sleight of hand tricks by saying the United States represents 25% of world GDP, but with its NATO allies, it represents 50% of world military spending. Well, that's true, but it's also true that on its own, the United States represents about 40% of world military spending. So I think there's a lot of reasons for Americans to think that the current configuration of effort inside NATO is a bad deal for American taxpayers at a time that we're $35 trillion in debt, running $1.5 trillion a year budget deficits with really red ink as far as the eye can see. And when it comes to Trump per se, I think there's an aphorism in Washington that personnel are policy. So Trump talked a big game during his first term, but didn't do much. I mean, he talked about at the very end of his administration, taking 12,000 troops out of Germany and sticking 5,000 of them into Poland. whether or not they would be at a place called Fort Trump was sort of to be determined. But I think if you saw certain individuals going into certain positions, if I were Europe, I would be really worried. Whereas in the first term, I think his staff really ran the policy by and large.
So Trump 2 will be different from Trump 1 if he's elected.
Well, it could be. I mean, no one knows who's going to take positions, national security advisor, State Department, et cetera. So I think if it were he to win, which is very much an open question, the first thing that I would start looking at is who got high-ranking political appointments at these things. And that would start to clarify whether the second Trump term notionally would look more like the first Trump term or more like the sort of European nightmare version where there are real serious changes to the U.S. presence in Europe.
All right. All scenarios are possible. Dominique Trinquant, remember, let's talk a minute about the French elections. We have a budget deficit, too, by the way. But we have this 7-year plan to boost military spending. We heard Keir Starmer over in the UK announce that he's pledging his commitment to 2.5% of GDP for spending for the UK, that there will be continuity from his conservative predecessors. Macron had talked up this embryo of an idea of a common European defense, not always just relying on NATO. After the election results of last Sunday, is that dead in the water?
No, I don't think so. I think since we've got the war in Ukraine, all European countries just wake up. And what Donald Trump was asking, the 2% GDP, is now reached by all European countries. So there is a movement. The point is the question mark about what Donald Trump will do if he's president. That's a big problem. I mean, in strategy, you can't rely on a question mark like that. You need to have, you know, security. And that's why I'm very often saying that European countries are increasing their budget and increasing their capacity in defense system inside NATO. But this by itself reinforce the European capacity to defend themselves. And they must think not to rely every 4 years about the election in US. I mean, the safety of Europe can't rely on election in US. They must rely on election in Europe and the capacity of the European of defending themselves. They forgot that for 30 years. Now, because there is war, they need to prepare themselves to defend Europe.
Let's cross back to, on that point, what's at stake with the current war in Ukraine, what we were talking about at the outset. For the Center for European Policy Analysis, former U.S. NATO ambassador Kurt Volker penned a paper called NATO at 75, Whistling Past the Graveyard. In it, he writes he warns that the final communique for this NATO summit won't go beyond the standard formulas on Ukraine. And he says this low bar was set and rigorously enforced by the United States and Germany, despite pleas for a more robust posture by several NATO allies. Washington and Berlin have made it clear that the key goal is not to provoke Putin and to avoid escalation. His defeat is still not the objective. You agree with that, Dominique Trinquant, that NATO's playing defense, or have times changed? And
I mean, we have a difficulty because, as you know, the alliance NATO is there to defend NATO country, and Ukraine is not a NATO country. So you need to stick to that, because if you don't stick to that, Putin is right. You know, it's NATO which is threatening Russia. So you need, by NATO means, to be very strict to the fact that the alliance is a defensive alliance. Then you've got the country who are making NATO, and they can have agreement with Ukraine. And this is something else. And in
Poland this week saying it could shoot down missiles from its territory.
Yes, it's fine. It's fine. It's just defensive of the defense of
it's
of
a bilateral
Poland,
deal
of Poland. Yeah, I mean, it's a, there is no question about that. But for example, in military terms, you know, EU has provided the same amount of money as US, but not in military terms, in payment to Ukraine. Ukraine can live with European money, but can't defend itself with European money. They need the U.S. money because it's the huge provider of military weapons in the world, and even in Europe. I mean, currently the European countries are equipped 60%, 70% by American weapon system. So this is the reality. U.S. is providing weapon system to Ukraine. Europe is providing money for Ukraine to survive.
Molly McHugh, do you agree with Kurt Volker that the U.S. and Germany are too defensive? I guess he's referring there to Taurus missiles.
It's probably a reference to a number of different issues, but it is true, at least as far as all of us know on the outside of the inside discussions, that the U.S. and Germany, that Biden and Scholz in particular, agree on a particular formula of how to approach the question of Russia and escalation against Russia. Many allies do not agree with that calculus, with the idea of how best to counter Russia. I think it's one of the biggest quiet divisions within the alliance that you see playing out in a variety of venues, including the debates about what the final language of the communique should be. But it is just a communique. And I think the overall tone that the Biden administration wanted to come out of the summit was one of a celebration of NATO's history. We are stronger and more unified than ever. But there is a real absence of planning for the future of the alliance that I think was a missed opportunity, particularly looking at NATO's posture toward Russia, toward what we are doing to support Ukraine, and toward what we want the outcome of that support to be.
So what should it be? I'll put the question to Ketevan in a moment to what's actually right now they're being talked about. But Molly, should NATO state black on white that yes, Ukraine should join?
I mean, we did that in 2008. That was the 2008 communique statement that Georgia and Ukraine will be members of NATO. So I don't care if you put irreversible in there or not this year as like a gimme to Ukraine. It's not changing the situation right now, which is they are outside of the Article 5 security guarantees that would have prevented this kind of war from happening because Russia does not want to take on NATO directly right now. So I think there's a lot of icing yet to be put on the cake, but we know what the cake is. And it's fine, and the alliance is making, I think, real efforts on a lot of things. I think there's been a lot of improvement in terms of European defense spending, how everybody is looking at what the priorities need to be in the coming years. The understanding that the United States can't carry as much of the ball all the time, I think, is a good point and a real one. But I don't think enough was done in the context of the lead up to the summit, knowing what a critical political pivot point we are at in the alliance and where we are in the war in Ukraine. Not enough has been done to plan for the future.
Ketevan Gorgestani.
I think in the negotiations, obviously, the Ukrainians want more. They always want more. And all of the leaders agree and acknowledge that it's normal that they want more. But at the same time, it's very complicated given how Article 5 works.
Just to remind our viewers, what is Article 5?
Article 5 is this one: an attack on one is an attack on all. And therefore, you go and defend your fellow allies in the NATO bloc. And so bringing in, whether you're talking about Ukraine or any other country, bringing in a country that is at war is just pretty much impossible if you're talking about right now, which is why the messaging, and yes, maybe irreversible is just a word, but it is the messaging is it's not if, it is when. That is the core of the messaging from NATO allies, which is that when the conditions are met, i.e. the big condition is that there is peace in Ukraine, then they will come into NATO. And I think that it was the leader of Lithuania earlier today who summed it up pretty well and showed this sort of disagreement between the Eastern Bloc and the Western Bloc of NATO, said maybe the wording of this final draft will not be with enough determination. Maybe some people are going to say that they're not in strong enough signals being sent to Ukraine, to Russia. But he said that this is a work of consensus, and we should praise the fact that we have such a strong consensus on what we have actually agreed on. And I think that shows also the fact that even though there are disagreements on how to go forward and what wording to put in that final communique, there is agreement in the direction in which they're going. And even the Eastern European countries acknowledge that and are happy with at least what they're getting.
Of course, there's one fly in the ointment if you want consensus, and that is Hungary's leader, Viktor Orban, who has been to Russia, to Azerbaijan, and to China in the last days.
Yes, and he is one of the issues that the NATO allies are looking at, and that same diplomatic source was saying...
Can he just be ignored?
He cannot just be ignored, but the question is how much of it is just speech, and in the end, is he going to block it? But the foreign minister of Hungary in Washington was singing the praises of a potential new Donald Trump presidency, which is something that we haven't heard from any other NATO ally, saying that it is a chance for peace if Donald Trump returns, and only President Trump is likely to be able to bring Russia and Ukraine to the negotiating table. The fact is that he's not the only one. Hungary and Viktor Orban is not the only sort of thorn in NATO's side. There's also Turkey's Recep Tayyip Erdogan that is not always in line with everybody else. And the fact that they are close to getting that final communique, if they agree on that wording, also shows that they managed to get that wording out, even with countries like Hungary and Turkey inside that alliance.
Not enough, Molly McHugh was said, General Trinquant, was done to reflect on what direction next for NATO. You agree with that?
I think, in fact, NATO, we are going back 30 years ago, yes, 40 years ago, when I was facing in Germany, I was facing the Soviet.
Was this West Germany or East Germany?
At that time, I was in West Germany, but I was facing East Germany. And so we are exactly going back to that time. I mean, we thought that this was impossible in Europe. Mr. Putin's action shows that it was possible. And so NATO now is reorganizing the old system. We're not talking about that because we're talking about politics. But in military terms, NATO is completely reorganizing the system to be able to face an attack on NATO soil.
Let me ask you about this because, you know, again, Article 5, an attack against one is an attack against all. It's now become a club of 32 nations. I believe this is the first NATO summit where Sweden is a full-fledged member. Here you see the two newest members, Swedish Prime Minister Ulf Kristersson and Finnish President Alexander Stubb. They flew in together to Washington. Does it matter that enlargement?
Oh, yes, very much, because Sweden has a very long border with Russia going far north of Russia. And so the extent of the border between NATO country and Russia has increased, in fact. And that's because Mr. Putin decided to attack Ukraine. But what I was saying is that inside the system, look at the Baltic Sea. The Baltic Sea is roughly a NATO sea now. You've got just a small Kaliningrad and St. Petersburg. But that's
here we can show the map of Europe, and in blue are all the NATO members.
And so the Russian Navy have no freedom of movement in the north and in the south, in the Black Sea. The only freedom of movement is, in fact, on the Asian side or in the north when it's not winter. So they are in a bigger difficulty. And that's caused by the action of Mr. Putin.
Justin Logan, you agree?
Well, I mean, that map certainly makes it clear the extent to which NATO has expanded beyond its original 12 members and crept ever closer to the Russian border. On the question of the irreversible path to Ukrainian NATO membership, I think we're missing one point that's important and a bit surreal here. In an interview with Time magazine last month, the president of the United States said that he opposes the, quote, NATOization of Ukraine, which is a weird formulation from the president. But he's made very clear that he doesn't view the United States as having interests in Ukraine that warrant fighting Russia over. Donald Trump, the Republican candidate for the presidency of the United States, has said the same thing, that U.S. troops would never fight Russia in Ukraine. So were we to make an Article 5 commitment to Ukraine, it seems to me that it would be inherently incredible. That is to say that both presidential candidates have said they don't think we have an interest there worth fighting over. And in the event of the Russian invasion, which happened 2 years ago, we revealed our preferences, that we in fact would not fight on behalf of Ukraine were it to be invaded. So I think we're really playing with something dangerous here if we create the idea that an Article 5 commitment may mean that we'll send some lawyers, guns, and money.
But the panel agrees that that's not in the cards right now. The Article 5. In fact, that it's being kicked down, the can's been kicked down the road with this sometime in the future.
But if we've stated clearly that we don't believe we have an interest in Ukraine worth going to war with Russia over, and if we've revealed through our actions that we don't believe we have an interest in Ukraine worth going to war with Russia over, why then would we make a paper commitment that says we will go to war with Russia over Ukraine? It's inherently incredible if you reflect on it for a moment.
Kedavan Gorgestani?
But that is focused on Ukraine. And one of the messages of the Ukrainians, but also of the whole Eastern Bloc, is the idea of if we don't stop him in Ukraine, he's going to come for a NATO member next. And that is the message that the Eastern Europeans have been saying for a while now. They said it in 2008 with Georgia. They said it when it happened in 2014 with Crimea. They said he is not going to stop. He's not simply going to stop at Ukraine. And the next step is possibly one of the Baltic states. And remember when Emmanuel Macron mentioned or hinted at the possibility of sending troops in Ukraine, when Vladimir Zelensky was asked about it, he said, look, we're not asking you to have your kids come and fight and die in Ukraine. But if you don't help us beat Russia, the next step is going to be your kids actually having to go to Lithuania, to Latvia, to protect a NATO member, because then that is what is going to happen. So maybe there's no Article 5 for Ukraine right now, but the idea is we need to help them block it now before it comes to a point where we will need to intervene.
Molly McHugh, we're out of time, but I have to ask you, because you're sitting in the Estonian capital and one of those former Soviet states there, and our people on this 75th anniversary, more heartened listening to General Trinkaus. They have heard the wake-up call, the fact that NATO is stronger than it used to be.
I think if you're ever in a Baltic state, what you know is they're happy. People are finally listening to what they've been telling the rest of the alliance since they joined in the early 2000s. They are very much planning for a future where they need to fight a confrontation with Russia. And I think they're trying to convince the rest of us to prepare for that as well, because preparation is deterrence. And that's what we want to achieve as the alliance.
Molly McHugh, many thanks for being with us from Tallinn. I want to thank Justin Logan in Washington, Dominique Trinkaus, Kedavan Gorgestani. Coverage of the NATO summit on our website, France24.com.